I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is National Security Analyst and former CIA operative in the Middle East, Robert Baer. He's joined in conversation by investigative journalist and professor Lowell Bergman. And now, join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Robert Baer and Lowell Bergman.
There's one person in the world who can say that George Clooney won an Oscar playing him. And that would be our guest tonight, Robert Baer. Syriana was adapted from his best-selling memoirs, See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil. Bob is one of the most accomplished CIA operatives in the agency's history. He has won the Career Intelligence Medal and speaks 8 languages. He spent much of his 21 years with the CIA in the Middle East, and one of his most notable assignments, of which there are plenty, was attempting to assassinate Saddam Hussein. He is currently National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN and one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East. He takes us on a wild adventure through the history of assassination in his latest book, The Perfect Kill. And in thinking about who the perfect fit would be to interview Bob tonight, obviously we needed someone with the appropriate gravitas and experience and deep knowledge of complex CIA and political history. And clearly we also needed someone who had been portrayed by a major movie star in a movie based on their work. So we are deeply honored to have Lowell Bergman here to interview Bob. Lowell is one of the founders of the Center for Investigative Reporting at UC Berkeley, where he is the Reva and David Logan Distinguished Chair in Investigative Journalism. He spent 22 years as a producer with ABC and CBS, and is currently a correspondent and producer for PBS's Frontline. And oh yeah, his investigation into the tobacco industry for 60 Minutes was chronicled in the film The Insider, and Al Pacino played Lowell. So please join me in welcoming the men George Clooney and Al Pacino could only pretend to be, Bob Baer and Lowell Bergman.
Well, good evening. Bob, you know, before I came here tonight, first time I ever heard your name was back in the early 1990s, and then one of your supervisors in Washington said to me, "We have this maniac out in the Middle East." Okay. How did you get into the CIA?
Well, you know, I think it was actually Berkeley's fault. I was studying Chinese, and I was going into a graduate program. And I was out of money and sort of looking for a job part-time. My roommate said, "You gotta get a job. You know, you can't study Chinese forever." So I thought this was very funny. And I said, "Well, maybe the CIA." And it was like, it was the Pike Committee, Church Pike Committee hearings. And he said, "Oh, that'd be hilarious." So I called up the Federal Center in San Francisco, and there was a long pause. And I think that the operator thought this was a joke or something. Anyhow, she found the number of the CIA, which was in Lawndale, California, which is down in Orange County. Is that Orange County? Yeah.
No, it's Palm Desert, I think.
It's like it's out in the middle of nowhere. I called them up, and they sent me an application. It was like 50 pages long, and only somebody unemployed would have the time to fill it out. And I said, "Look, there's no way I was going to get hired. My mother used to teach at UCLA. Little red schoolhouse in those days. I'd grown up in Aspen. The only thing I knew how to do was ski race and barely got through college." And I said, "This is not going to work." He called me up one day and said, "Let's go." And 21 years later, I was still in.
All right. So, and just to make sure that everybody understands, you say, "Let's go." You are a CIA officer. Right.
Yeah, I was what was called a case officer. And when I applied for the job here, they described it to me, what an analyst does. He actually, she or he works for the CIA. It's in their, on their resume. They have cards for it. You know, everybody knows they go to academic conferences. And, you know, they go to school and things like that. And I told the guy in this interview, that's what I want. He says, well, without an MA, you can't have that. But we've got this other job where people go overseas and they drive around at night, pick up agents, and they debrief them, and they steal secrets, and they carry guns and things like that. Seriously, I didn't even watch James Bond films. I mean, just, and I didn't own a gun either. And I said, yeah, I'll take it, sure, if that's fine. You know, just, you know, I'll do bungee jumping. You know, if you say it's a year from now, I say, yeah, let's go. But when it comes time to go. So anyhow, the CIA is divided into analysts who are, you know, sort of wannabe academics, and operatives who go to weird places like Iraq and Afghanistan and collect intelligence. Or as the FBI describes the CIA, is they're the, we catch bank robbers and they rob banks.
Right. So basically you had a license to steal, to lie.
Oh yeah, no, well, if you ever want to do a break-in, let me know. It could break into banks. You were expected to lie from the time you got up in the morning to the time you went to bed. You figured your phone was tapped, and you would just tell these fantastic stories. If you were going out to the drugstore, you would just completely say something totally opposite in the conversation to throw people off. It was just misdirection your entire life.
Okay. And so you go into this, though, in the wake of the church committee hearings, the so-called reforms of the 1970s related to the intelligence community, things that many things which are now by the boards, the national security, you know, the FISA law, and so on. So how did that restrict you at that time? Did it in any way?
Well, I think that they had a hard time getting people to time, so that's why they took me. You know, it's they, and like I said, I came from a liberal family. My mother ran for county commissioner, Pitkin County, Colorado. And the other half of the ticket was Hunter Thompson, if anybody can remember that. I mean, she was a socialist, and he wanted the sheriffs to drop mescaline. So, I mean, don't ask me how the CIA missed this, but they did.
But they missed many things.
They missed a lot of things. It's like when I applied, they sent a security guy around the neighborhood. He had a suit on and a tie and everything. And I lived with this. And Berkeley used to be fairly liberal at one time. And I had these roommates, they were both anarchists, and I was studying Chinese, and I had put very cleverly on the wall a picture of Mao Zedong, and I'd written in Chinese, "The East Wind Blows Red." And they owned a boa constrictor. So there was this knock on the door, I came down, and I was home alone, and there was this guy, said, do you know Mr. Barry, your neighbor? And I said, well, that's me. And right then, the boa constrictor started coming out of the second floor, coming down, and I don't know what he wrote in his report, but I got through security. I'm just telling you.
I just wanted to make sure all of you understood who we're dealing with. Okay, so let me fast forward to this book, because you've had a number of books. Okay. When you were in the CIA, you couldn't kill anybody, could you? Or you couldn't assassinate.
No, you could not assassinate. When you came in, you had to sign an agreement that you had read and understood the meaning of Executive Order 1233, which is you can't kill anybody as a CIA officer. It's against the law. You go directly to jail. And if you talked to anybody who proposed murder, you had to break off contact. It was clear cut. And, you know, you go back in the 40s and the 50s, and you see these, well, you had the Castro stuff, of course, but that never really got off the ground. I mean, you know, 61, the Bay of Pigs, that was over. But that was never very serious, going to the mob. And we sort of held that out, the whole assassination thing of Castro, is just a really dumb idea, and we're never going to do it again. And every officer, whether they were analysts or operatives, had to sign this order, and they were very serious about it.
So in your 21 years, you, and we'll get to the Saddam incident and Mugniya or Hajj, Radwan and your obsession with him in a minute, but in your 21 years, you never got to kill anybody, is that right?
No.
Not with your hands, not with your weapon.
I never killed anybody. I never threw a grenade into a school bus. I never... I was issued pistols but didn't like it. I'd keep the magazines out. I was always afraid I was going to shoot myself in the foot. They gave us machine guns and mortars and all this stuff and a lot of training, military training, jumping out of airplanes. But it was more like, hey, guys, this is what it's all about. So when you talk to people, you have familiarity with guns. Mm-hmm. But it was you were never going to go out and shoot anybody. I mean, it just if you even talked about shooting anybody, they'd run you out.
And how do you wind up going to Lebanon? Because that becomes your obsession, at least for a decade or more.
I studied Arabic, and I worked in a consulate in... I studied Arabic for 2 years, and I worked in a consulate in the Middle East interviewing people for visas, which solidified Arabic, needless to say. So after 4 years in this assignment, Lebanon had, at that point, had gone to hell in the sense that our chief of station had been kidnapped. The embassy had been blown up in April 83, the Marines in October, second embassy in 84, and they had a list of people who spoke Arabic and would go to Beirut, and that was me. I mean, in fact, I was walking down the hall. I was in Africa division at the time. Don't ask me why I got thrown out of the Near East division, but I did. So I was walking down, and they said, "Don't you speak Arabic?" "Yeah, do you want to go to Beirut?" I said, "Yeah, let's go." And so it was like another prank, like joining the CIA. I'll tell you, when you win, it got your attention because you took a helicopter from Cyprus. It was a Black Hawk, and there were two of them. It'd come out, and the whole idea of commuting in a helicopter was all a bit strange. But when it got to Beirut, the helicopter dropped down about 10 to 15 feet off the ocean floor. So he was spraying, and the guys, get their 50-caliber machine guns in the doors, put their flak vests on. CIAs didn't get flak vests, and they come in and they're going right into shore, and this thing turns on its side. These guys were from Delta Force, the pilots, flipped over hills and landed. And they said, "You got 10 seconds to get out of the helicopter and all your stuff, otherwise, I'm going to push you out." And then you were there in Beirut, and the place was burning, and there was shelling going everywhere. It was like Apocalypse Now.
And so, what do you discover? You're supposed to be hunting who did the embassy, right?
I was sent there mainly to look for the hostages because they had completely disappeared. You know, this is Bill Buckley, AP reporter, and we go right to where, a guy from AUB, American University of Beirut. They had disappeared. And at that
point... Bill Buckley was the...
The chief of station, yeah.
The top CIA officer, not only in Beirut.
And I mean, when they've kid, he completely disappeared. He was hit over the head at his apartment coming out, thrown in the back of a car, disappeared in the southern suburbs, and we completely lost trace of him. You also had the question of the embassy in April 83, which was blown up by a GMC pickup truck that managed to get in underneath the portico and exploded. And it was the first suicide bombing against the United States, which was a huge mystery to us at the time. It mystified that the FBI, that the guys who had made the explosives, actually wrapped them around the firing device so there was no signature on the bomb, which was a huge... There are always signatures on bombs. There was none on that. The truck had been stolen. The suicide bomber, we couldn't identify. Even it was such a thorough explosion that there was no traces on the wall. And this was clearly of such professionalism that nobody in the United States government had ever seen this, period. So that you're presenting me with this mystery to try to solve who blew up our embassy.
And they blew up the French barracks?
The French barracks in October, along with the Marines. Mm-hmm. I believe that they were involved in Lockerbie, Pan Am 103, same people. They were clearly at a level way beyond Bin Laden or ISIS in terms of communications. They didn't have any communications.
At this point, the Shia, either Hezbollah or the Iranians, were killing more Americans than any other terrorist group in history, right?
Barring none, 200 and what was it, 71, 61 at the Marine Barracks. Mm-hmm. If you don't remember this, they took a step van and they drove it right through the guards and up the steps and into the barracks. It caused Reagan to pull out of Lebanon, the biggest loss of Marines since World War II in a single day. I mean, this. I until this day, I've never seen professionalism like this in a group.
And you were our secret weapon on the ground?
I was it. The failed ski racer from Aspen, Colorado, is gonna solve this. Yeah.
So what did you do?
You had to figure out Lebanon, which meant working. And this is. I wasn't serious about anything until I got to this big question. And that was to use intercepts, reading hundreds and hundreds of them a day. Because in Lebanon, with the phones gone, they were using low-power communications. And it's sort of a basin in Beirut. And you can pick these up. You have a site. And it was very complicated. They would write this stuff out. And it was just simply, we called them matrices at the time. Today they call them algorithms, and it's all done by computers. But at the time, I had stacks of in some of my office of these intercepts.
And in the process, you started to zero in on basically the perfect killer, the man behind it.
Yeah. His name is Imad Mughniyeh. He's Lebanese, born 62. He had trained with Fatah. He had gone to the battlefront when he was about 15. Took a year off to study business affairs for AUB. Don't ask me why. And then in 1982, he was recruited by Iran, by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and put on the front line and assigned to start killing Americans. He was. Remember the explosions in Argentina? Mm-hmm. I think he was clearly involved in that.
That's not till 90.
Yeah, this is a continuous shedding American blood for 20 years.
This is the Israeli embassy and the Jewish community center.
Yeah, in Argentina, and he set off bombs in Paris in 85. Remember those? Mm-hmm. The department stores. He set one off in London. There was nobody like him, period. I mean, in terms of simple capabilities of his ability to disappear and stay off telephones, and talk about misdirection. The guy was simply brilliant at what he did.
So he's the guy, in a sense, he's your white whale in this book. He's the guy you're hunting.
Oh, he's absolutely the white whale, yeah. This is the guy that I wanted bad. And don't ask me when that switch flipped. Now, what we had on the guy was a sealed arrest warrant. And it was from the Department of Justice. And we were, if we ever got in the position to arrest him, we were supposed to notify the marshals and the FBI and the rest of it and go through a whole procedure. I mean, a guy like this is obviously not going to be arrested by the marshals or the FBI, and they're not going to come to Beirut. And the Lebanese police aren't going to arrest him. I mean, he had his own passport file stolen from the police, all of his records. He had all of his records that he'd ever gone out of Beirut Airport erased from the hard drives and the physical records. So at that point, I sat down with the ambassador, John Kelly, the chief of station, and a guy named Chuck McKee and a couple other people and said, look, we could get close to this guy, but he's going to resist and he's going to probably die. And the ambassador said, well, that's a hypothetical. You know, I don't deal with hypotheticals. When you get to that point to arrest him. But for me, that was open season on the guy. Hypotheticals.
Hypothetically, there was no longer an executive order 1233.
When we get to Iraq, I mean, it's if somebody's resisting arrest, and this is how bin Laden was killed. He was considered an enemy combatant and dangerous, and shoot him. I mean, it's lawyers, it's definitions, you know. It's against the law to assassinate people. But if you describe the situation as a war zone, and you can do it anywhere, you can kill somebody. If I could just have a small footnote here, I had a conversation with a SEAL from SEAL Team 6, and he's out. And I was living in Berkeley at the time, and I said, tell me about your authorities. And he said, well, listen, if we get a PID on somebody, I said, what's a PID? It's a positive identification. We can go in them unless there's total submission, and that's like you're on the ground without your clothes off, everything, and you have no threat to anybody at all. they can't shoot you, but it's short of that, they can shoot you. And I said, look, I'm living in Berkeley at the time. And I said, if I'm in Berkeley and you get a PID, can SEAL Team 6 come through the windows and kill me? Yep, including on U.S. soil. Now, of course, the context for that is if the United States lost control of part of the country in some conflict. Mm-hmm. But if you take that idea as well, as much as I understand it, and I didn't go to law school, you can apply it to Yemen. Al-Awlaki, the American imam that was killed, Bin Laden, SEAL Team 6 is very capable, could have clearly grabbed that guy alive.
You're listening to former CIA operative Robert Baer, whose latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. He's joined in conversation by Lowell Bergman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
But in your book, the way that you describe Mugniyah or Hajwat Radwan, right?
Radwan.
You describe him as being focused. He knows his enemy. He knows what he's going to accomplish in this particular action that he's going to do. He has a political objective of some kind that's limited. He doesn't waste energy. He doesn't waste time. He has a follow-up operation. I mean, it's almost a love poem to him in the sense of seeing an expert do what he does. But you say exactly the opposite about what we're doing.
I'm a contrarian, and I don't like American foreign policy. I think we assassinated bin Laden in 2011, and we have something a lot worse in ISIS and al-Baghdadi, because we will not acknowledge that we are dealing with an insurgency, a Sunni insurgency, and assassination isn't going to do you any good at all. I mean, we've taken political murder to the Middle East hoping it's a detour around war, or at least shorten war, but it's not what we've got, because in Iraq we are going into what I think is going to be a 100 years war. I mean, I don't see any sense in playing the Air Force to Iran in Iraq, and that's what we're doing. They are selecting the targets, and we are hitting them with the Air Force and drones. It's just not going to work. But if you take Lebanese context, in 1999, Haj Radwan was trying to force the Israelis out of Lebanon to leave. And they had a security. And what he did was, in a very technically brilliant operation, hit the Israeli commander with a shape charge. He was traveling at high speed and hit him directly in the door. And the Israelis pulled out in less than a year, saying, this enemy is too capable. We are better off pulling our forces back, defending Israel proper rather than staying in Lebanon. The security zone, which Mugniyah was hitting them hard, it's too expensive, and we'll simply hit them with mass force, which they did in 2006, which worked. So what he did, because assassination, the purpose is to preserve force and avoid war. But if you're assassinating people and it's getting you deeper into war, you're going against the whole intent of it. And this is the argument I make. We simply cannot project American power around the world using political murder. If we were confined to a space like Lebanon, where there's only 4 million people, and when Mugniyah, Haj Radwan, killed people, it was with a very specific purpose, and his intelligence was perfect. He was listening to phones and the rest of it. But then I go in farther into the story, because I worked for the United Nations on an assassination investigation, and that was the prime minister who was killed in 2005. And what had Mugniyah did kill him with a car bomb and 20 other people. He had gone from taking this as a tactic to avoid war to a sectarian conflict and killed a man who was a symbolic head of the Sunni in Lebanon. And it's only got them more violence, and it'll get them more. So he broke all his rules. He started to break them. He did very well for about 20 years. And he made other mistakes, too. Like he remarried and moved to Damascus and started using a cell phone and kept a certain house. You know, he lived in a certain house, and he then set himself up as a target, and he was assassinated in 2008.
But are you saying that for 20 years, or until he was assassinated in 2008, and we'll get to the assassination in a minute, he managed to avoid the NSA, the CIA, all of our military intelligence people, SEAL Team 6?
And Mossad.
And Mossad
dearly wanted to kill him. And they know what they're doing. They were after him. They killed his brother. He completely disappeared. He used to ride a motor scooter and pretend to be a tailor, a butcher, or something like that. Completely, he was unknown even in Hezbollah, which nominally he was under that umbrella. He was unknown. People didn't know who he was. Maybe three or four people did.
No defectors, nobody that could be turned?
Never had a defector from Mugnia's side. We had one from other hostage takers. We've had him from the Iranians. But never in his group was there anybody came out that betrayed him, no.
And what do you account? How do you account for that? I mean, you were in your book. You say you were worried at one point that you were going to get hit by him.
Oh, I think definitely they were looking at us. I mean, the problem is I grew up middle class and I didn't grow up in a war zone. I mean, you take people who have been in a civil war, and their families are getting killed and they're killing people. They tend to figure out what they're doing, and it's the Darwin effect. I mean, when I talk about, you know, the admiration is for his skill, but I certainly wouldn't trade my life for his. Growing up in the southern suburbs
of
Beirut, and, you know, as a teenager, leaving school with a Kalashnikov and going shooting at the other side. I mean, this part of the world that's falling off, progress and sort of any. Anything we take as civilization is growing by the day. I mean, you look at Mali, you look at Nigeria with Boko Haram, you look at ISIS, which is truly pre-Islamic. I mean, this cutting off heads with knives is tribal, or kidnapping women. This is tribal. It has nothing to do with Islam. So this world, the world of Mugniyas, the ability to murder people for political ends, there are more and more people that are capable of doing this. And it was my interest in because this is part memoir. I mean, I write my mother into the story. She was a great character.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what is your mother doing in the middle of Lebanon?
Well, she was a great character assassin, so. And she should have had my job, but that's beside the point. But so, I mean, I want to make it personal how far I am from this world. And even how far the CIA is. Yes, we can put drones up and we can sit in front of a flat panel screen and kill people, but this is not our world.
Well, you write that the best assassins or the best kills are local. What do you mean by that?
Well, the best kills are inside the family. I mean, you know who the cancer is. You know who the problem is in removing them. It is local. I mean, take one of the great assassinations, this historically determining assassination, that was Rabin in 1995. I think if anybody could have, you know, cut to the chase on a Middle East settlement, was him. I mean, he was a hero, he was well respected, but if you take the point of his enemies, removing him truly made a difference. But that was very local. It's kind of politics I don't understand. But for them, it made sense. And of course, then I go back to the idea of killing Hitler. I mean, that would have saved lives and avoided destruction untold, and especially if it had been done in 1933. There are occasionally figures in history which are cancerous, and they should be cut out. I mean, the whole idea, we hate assassination. As Americans, we just hate the idea. We hate to admit we do it.
But we do it. We've done it to Lincoln. We've done it to McKinley. We've done it to more. The most dangerous job in the world, actuarially, is president of the United States.
Yeah, exactly. But that's why we hate it so much. We think of Kennedy. We think of Lincoln. And it's lunatics and the rest of it. But what we're missing is the ability to change history at a particular moment in a particular context, it does save lives. And I think we're, and the reason I wrote this book is to examine this modern assassination. I talk about Laos in here very briefly. An academic from University of Minnesota went out there and found out that at a certain point in Laotian history, there were political assassinations. I mean, that the local communities, and the Laos are not violent people, they felt for the community's survival, they had to kill certain people, and they did. And he found that it was a successful, the most successful possible route to conflict resolution. And that's something we don't want to admit.
No, it reminds me, we had a local assassin here in the San Francisco area, a man named James the Weasel Fratiano, who was a mafia guy. And eventually he became a semi-celebrity, wrote a book, he flipped over and became a government witness. And I had the experience of having been sued by him, but then later interviewed him.
At least he didn't kill you.
Huh?
At least he didn't kill
you. No, he told me that we only kill each other.
Okay.
Right? And you know, he never killed anybody who didn't deserve it.
Well, you know, no, that's funny, but at the heart of assassination, it has to be a just act. I mean, it has to be, I think not only for the assassin, it has to be a peer. You can't be making money off this or things like that. It has to be an act of justice, and even the victim side has got to look at it saying, yeah, and we know why you did it. The guy was really bad.
To preserve the community or the organization and discipline.
You know, and once I got deeper into this, I started talking to crazier and crazier people, and some of them were biologists, and they said, well, you know, in cell biology, there's a thing, and if, correct me if I'm wrong, it's apoptosis, where the cells will kill another cell that's cancerous.
And so Mignia, or Haj Radwan, escaped you. Is the reason you wrote this book to detail all of your nightmares about him and try to figure it out?
Well, Lowell, it's engagement. I mean, I think me and my team are the first Americans that have ever brought up and been in charge of assassination of a world leader by the Department of Justice and the FBI. So for me, which I'm actually in the middle of something, I start to understand it. I can get engaged. I can think about it.
And I say this again.
I was in Iraq in 1995, and we had an
opportunity. With Ahmed Chalabi.
Yeah, with Ahmed Chalabi, but he wasn't part of it. And the general came to me and said, listen, I represent five officers in Baghdad, general officers, and we would like to get rid of Saddam, lift the sanctions. Would you support a coup d'etat? And I said, sounds good to me. I was the CIA chief in Iraq. Sat down, wrote it up, sent it back on an attack set, which is classified, and it didn't get an answer. And eventually they came to me and said, well, Saddam is going to go to his palace at Auja, and we've suborned 12 tanks, and we've got the tank shells for him, and what we're going to do is, once you get in the palaces, we're going to ask him to step down, and we're going to kill him with the tanks. And I said, well, you know, is a tank's main gun an assassination weapon? I obviously didn't know that, so I sent a message back to Washington saying, you know, this is their plan. Are we okay? Are we in good ground? You know. I never got an answer. This action went forward. It was unstoppable at that point. And some of the militias I was working with overran three Iraqi divisions. And it was quite messy, the whole engagement. And then I got a message from Washington saying, if you have a criminal lawyer, don't talk to him. Come right home. Trust us on this. There's been a problem. So we come back, badged by the FBI. Have you ever had your office yellow taped by the FBI? It's interesting. And they said, we're hauling you in for the attempted murder of Saddam Hussein. Eventually got through this investigation. But, I mean, even though we never actually pulled the trigger on Saddam, it gave me an insight in the way, the thinking, the lawyers, what it's like in the field, how hard it is to target somebody like Saddam, just as it would be al-Baghdadi today, somebody on the move no communications, you don't have eyes on, and the rest of it. So this is an examination of assassination, and it's sort of a funny title, but the perfect kill is nearly impossible. It's a black swan event.
But what you do talk about is the use of indiscriminate violence, whether it's drones or cruise missiles or by the U.S., as a tactic that's only going to backfire, that isn't going to succeed in the end.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Lowell, we're doing what's called signature strikes, in that you have a drone flying above, and they see a couple guys with Kalashnikovs, you know, doing exercises in a field, and somebody back in Washington says, well, you know, they're near this village. This doesn't look right to us. We haven't had a drone strike in a month. Let's drop one. You know, it's the mountains of Yemen or Pakistan. And you look at some years, we'll have, 750 drone strikes, and not a single name will ever appear of who we know it is. I mean, it's amazing. Or in cars or... And we've overused it. The whole point of political murder is to make it very precise. I mean, you really scare the enemy when you get to the one guy who's causing you a problem rather than, you know, somebody who appears to be legal.
I noticed a difference. In November of 2002, I was doing a story about the Lackawanna Six. I don't know if you remember the so-called terror sleeper cell in Lackawanna, New York. And they were recruited by a guy named Kamal Derwish, who had lived in Saudi Arabia for a long time but was an American citizen. And in November of 2002, a drone fired a missile at a vehicle in Yemen and blew the car up, and he was in the car. He was the first American citizen killed in the counterterrorism
war. I remember that, yeah.
And at that time, the U.S. government backed off of the whole thing. Oh, he was collateral damage. We didn't mean to do it. He was in the wrong car at the wrong time. Today, we take credit for it.
Well, I don't think there's any outrage. I mean, it's so complicated. Pakistan and Yemen and now Syria and Iraq, that people are just jaded. You know, they just don't care. You know, they don't care about the legal authorities. They don't care about the accuracy of drones. It's just like they don't care about enhanced interrogations. I mean, you know, frankly, I've been keeping track of this, and this is an aside, but the Senate has got 6,000 documents that say it doesn't work, and you got a few people involved in torture who say it does, and my feeling is I want to see those 6,000 documents. I mean, I want to make up my mind as an American whether torture makes us safer or not. I mean, that doesn't justify it morally, but I'd like to know, but we still don't know. I mean, there's two sides to this. I can't imagine that the Senate would just, you know, come to these conclusions that torture doesn't work, you know, because they want to. You know, I think they're basing it on evidence. So, and the war on terror is, I mean, it's gone everywhere. I mean, it's in Somalia, it's in, you know, in Africa, in, you know, who knows where it's going to go next. Anywhere where there's blank spots on the map, we can carry war. But do we really stop to see what it's getting us? I mean, I don't know.
Has there been in your experience, because I remember, and remember some of your bosses, I remember also FBI people who came in to the FBI in the mid-70s or back then, and they learned in a sense about what could go wrong from the Church Committee hearings, from the Pike Committee hearings, and there was a sense that we've got to be more focused, we've got to be smarter about what we do. Have we lost that caution? Are those lessons no longer alive inside the intelligence community?
I think we've lost them. I mean, when I joined the CIA, it was very simple. It was Moscow was the problem. You had to recruit a Russian military officer to tell you when they were going to send armored divisions through the Fulda Gap. It was that simple. But once it got into terrorism... And of course, after 9/11, it became very complicated. But for me, what was more complicated, or that's made things a lot worse, is that we're in the Middle East has gotten so dangerous that everybody's sort of locked up in a bubble in the hotel in Kabul or the Green Zone. And we're looking at the world through drones, and I'm not sure you can understand it just looking at drones.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features former CIA operative Robert Baer, whose latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. He's joined in conversation by Lowell Bergman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So what happened to the CIA after I left was it became a killing machine. And that's what people do. And now they're doing it in Syria and Iraq. And I don't think they do it particularly well. I think you're missing a lot of the nuances. The whole attack on Mosul, on ISIS in June, was apparently missed. President called it the JV team. You know, he was misled. It wasn't his fault.
But the president, who was a constitutional law scholar, or so he taught that at law school, he's approved all these things.
Well, I can offer you my political opinion. I mean, I think you have a president who's was fairly liberal Democrat, has to cauterize the right. I mean, he has to take actions that even went beyond Bush. I mean, he's increased in drone strikes. He went after leaks. He's gone after Ryzen, the New York Times, which even Bush wouldn't do, simply to send the message that I don't play around with national security. And I think this is what a lot of the drone strikes are, is simply his trying to be strong without sending American troops back to the Middle East.
So it's a bloodless way of saying you're a tough guy.
Americans don't care. Do you rarely see anything on, you know, people going in and taking pictures of where drones hit or keeping track of this. I'm not talking about, you know, I'm talking about the, you know, between San Francisco and New York, there's a big part of the United States that just assumes that we got to be doing this. They don't look very, very deep into that.
I want to get back to the notion of assassination. It seems to me assassination has been part of American history.
Yeah, but you're looking at the psychopaths. I mean, you're looking at Kennedy. You're looking at
John Wilkes Booth.
I mean, clearly assassinating Lincoln at that time wasn't going to do the South any good. It was an act of revenge. But all these assassinations, I think we can just dismiss as simple criminal acts and not carried out by a coherent political organization with a real plan.
And so our assassinations have no plan, but our enemy is focused? Is that the lesson you're telling us?
Yeah. Let's go back to Hajar 1. 1989, the Syrians and the United States agreed on a new president. They were going to close down his ball at the time. They were going to civilize Lebanon and more or less slow down or stop the war against Israel in the south. And Mugniyeh, it was 17 days after the president was nominated, set up an operation where he put explosives and a shape charge in a closed-down candy store, and the president's convoy was going by and hit it, killed the president, cut his car in half. The Lebanese president cut his car in half. That was the end of any talk about closing Hezbollah down or any talk of restoring the Lebanese state. Mugniyeh did not have a grievance against that president, but they felt that they, in their interests, we're talking about their interests, not ours, felt that they had to cut off, they had to get rid of this man because he was a danger to what they were doing, and that was the Islamic resistance in the south. He did have a plan, and they followed this plan consistently. And once they had committed violence, they didn't go on to commit more symbolic violence. And they avoided things like car bombs, which in Lebanon, as you know, everybody was using them. They went out of their way never to use one in built-up areas. And what they were doing was sending a message to their enemies that we c- can use violence responsibly. And then when we get what we want, we will hold to the agreement. Mugnia did it with the French in 85 and 86. He had a simple message: I'm going to kill you and kidnap you until you stop supplying weapons to Iraq. And that's exactly what happened. And after the French, Chirac, made that agreement, Mugnia stopped killing Frenchmen, which is something you don't see from Al-Qaeda or ISIS, who just tend to slaughter. So the French felt that they had a rational player at the other end.
So you're saying that he was a master of using political violence to get a political end.
To get a political end, and then once he got that end, he stopped.
So you and your friends in Lebanon decided you wanted to take him out.
Sure.
What was so difficult? You've got the NSA, you've got money to bribe people, you've got allies in the Christian side of town, and probably allies in the Sunni side of town because he's a Shia.
We went to our allies, the Christians, and they said, "Are you out of your mind?" They were terrified of him. He could operate in the West. The Sunni wanted to have no part of it. He stayed off any sort of communications, moved from night to night. He completely disappeared into the southern suburbs, which he could do. That was what we called a denied area. And we used to send cars through it.
The area that was like, no, there was off the grid completely, but it had its own grid up in the air of electrical wires and Iranian generators on corners painted with the Iranian flag on it. And nobody would go down.
Nobody would. The army, the Syrians were scared. I mean, when Ghazi Kanan, the intel chief, the Syrians, I mean, he was a fairly powerful guy in Lebanon, refused to set foot in the suburbs, the southern suburbs. And they were scared of him. I mean, but that's the whole point of the book is that, you know, we were not qualified to do this, and he was qualified to come after us. If he'd paid me any attention at all, he could have easily found me and got rid of me. But he probably didn't think it was worth the bullet.
Your name wasn't written on one of his bullets.
No, my name was not on one of his bullets. We weren't a threat. He had closed the Americans down, got rid of the Marines, closed the embassy down. It was a bubble. The Central Intelligence Agency was not a threat to him.
Well, he killed everybody who was an expert in the area.
Yeah, he killed Buckley, Buckley. And the embassy, he blew up the embassy and killed six CIA people. But, I mean, in the embassy bombing, I think, was going after Phil Habib, was the ambassador then. Because Phil Habib was trying to make a peace between Israel and Lebanon. And he opposed that clearly, just like he killed the president. But again, let's go back. It was a very small area with very narrow grievances, and everybody knew who everybody was, and it wasn't some grand strategy. When he did move to bigger targets, and he was involved in Khobar Barracks in Saudi Arabia in 1996, which is a bomb that went off near the barracks and killed two dozen American soldiers, it was a wasted gesture. He also tried to kill the Emir of Kuwait with his brother-in-law, and that failed. So he looked at this ability to project political violence a long way away, and it doesn't really work. And he withdrew and came back. He would continually learn about what worked and what didn't.
And so I don't want to give away the end of your book, but what's the lesson of all of this? I mean, that he could do this and survive until he was apparently assassinated in 2008, right? That he could survive so long.
Which is absolute, utter discipline. I mean, we have found the same thing with our special operators, the Delta Force and the SEALs. I mean, when they first went into Afghanistan, you had the Luttrell book, you know, where the helicopter went down, they lost a bunch of guys. We learned, our special operators learned how to fight wars, and they're very good at what they do. They change tactics, for instance, in Iraq, where they come into a house. It used to be called I'll give you a technical term, a dynamic entry, and that was hostage rescue. And then they got ambushed one time, and they said, well, we're going to do combat entry. And that's basically shoot anybody that moves in the house, because we learned how to fight wars. And, you know, we are, they still haven't, you know, gotten to his ability to do this. Well, they did in a sense that when he went down in 2008, but I won't talk about that now. So, you know, getting to the morality of it, I don't touch morality. And I'm looking at human nature. I'm looking at a bunch of assassinations and explain why they worked or they didn't work. And this is very much a political science book, but what I did was, when I first wrote it, there was 21 laws, and they're pretty snappy, is I didn't want to write an anthology. It'd be fairly boring. So I wrote through this narrative of trying and failing to kill Mugnea. And then I had to throw some stories about my mother in, which is like lightens it up. I don't know if it lightens it up or...
Well, I like you being embarrassed and leaving the restaurant.
Yeah.
But it's 21 lessons for something that you say in the end you don't believe it.
It's 21 conditions that you have to meet before you can hope to carry off a successful political murder. But if you read each one carefully, they get harder and harder and harder. Like, don't ever miss. And, you know, it sounds funny, don't miss, but, you know, when they tried to kill Henry V and they failed, he just became a stronger king. It was considered some sort of divine ordinance that he was chosen, and he became a stronger, you know, he invaded France and took Normandy and Calais and the rest of it. Same way, you just simply can't afford, and I get into the IRA attempt at Margaret Thatcher, when they put a lot of explosives in a room, and there was no chance of ever killing her because it was so far away. And the IRA at the end of it, I don't think it got anything out of it. I mean, if things would have been different if they had killed the British Prime Minister. But the ones that work, you call it terror if you like, but a capable assassin is clearly more, something you got to worry about, and you better change your behavior as opposed to a bumbling assassin. I mean, that's an obvious rule. Not leaving your fingerprints on an assassination is also scary. I mean, like blowing up the embassy in April 1983, it certainly scared the FBI and the CIA when they saw this complete explosion, you know, destroyed the firing device. I mean, we knew what we were up against, and as opposed to Bin Laden, who, you know, goes on TV and was locked up in a house in Abbottabad. Al-Qaeda doesn't really exist now. It's not a formidable organization. It's turned into something worse, but he clearly wasn't as capable as Mugnea.
You say it's not a formidable organization, but the Pentagon would tell you that's because our drones have taken their leadership out in the Northwest Territories, and we've tracked them down.
Al-Qaeda was a pickup operation, and I'm just reflecting what people tell me that have followed this from the beginning, inside the government. Atta, Hamburg, puts this together, gets some money, a little bit of money from Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, shows up and says, hey, we're going to do this, and he says, yeah, fine, go do it. They got very lucky, as the Pentagon told me over and over again, that our paradigm changed on 9/11, with Flight 93, that no, you can't give up the cockpits. There are people willing to kill themselves. So in a sense, we had made a major, the passengers had on Flight 93, once they heard about the World Trade Center. So that changed. And I don't think you can look at ISIS as an existential threat. I mean, it terrifies me that they're going to set off an explosion in this country and kill a bunch of people. It won't only be a tragedy, but it will be an incentive to go into more wars in the Middle East, which we ultimately can't win. And I think the problem with Sunni violence in the Middle East, it is so indiscriminate. Killing journalists, setting car bombs off in Baghdad, the World Trade Center. I think this is a very aggrieved, damaged religious sect whose survival is at stake here, and you have a fringe that is lashing out with this extreme violence, which with Mugnia, he had wanted everybody out of his country as opposed to, you know, changing the American way of life or striking out at us. I mean, I think he could have done set off a bomb in New York or Chicago, and we trace groups here. He just didn't want to. It was the narrow channeling of violence is much more efficient, and people are ready to go on. Because what do we do with Lebanon? We just got up and left. You know, we bombed it in 84 in the spring a little bit, and then we just left. I mean, no real damage.
We had the battleship New Jersey going up.
Yeah, I was in the Becca at the time. They never hit anything. You can. The shells were the size of Volkswagens, you know, and they just, you'd sit in the Becca and you'd hear them fly over and explode. And, I mean, the Lebanese were convinced we were firing blanks, you know, but it didn't deter anybody.
And so Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, apparently was just wounded, right?
In Sunday.
Is that going to make any difference?
No. He's. We tend not to listen to our enemies, which is always a big mistake. I listened to his sermon in Mosul, and he's very. His Arabic is just riveting. I mean, it's very beautiful Arabic, and he didn't sound crazy. But you have to look at Baghdadi and ISIL or ISIS or whatever we're calling it is a manifestation of these grievances of people in that area. You know, when you have that much chaos, the default is to some purified imaginary point in history, which these people are trying to return to. So we could kill Baghdadi today, he could have died on Saturday, and there wouldn't be any change, really. You would have somebody, he'd be replaced. And the British chief of staff even said this. He went on TV on Sunday morning and said, hey, guys, we can get rid of him. It's not going to do us any good. So political murder is not going to work there. You know, if the Islamic State were on the run and were falling apart and you could get rid of its leadership, it would speed it up. But right now, it's here to stay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was former CIA operative Robert Baer, whose latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. He was joined in conversation by Lowell Bergman. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finley. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.